We're microbially, immunologically stitched together as one organism. And what I do to my body, I'm doing to yours. What I put on or into my body, I'm putting on or into the air, the ocean, into your lungs, your veins, and vice versa. So my medical condition illustrates that reality in a very stark and unavoidable way. But it's true for all of us.
Welcome to Enabling Commons, a place for conversations with activists, experts, and scholars at the intersections of disability and climate change. The podcast is produced by the Disability Inclusive Climate Action Research Program based at McGill University. I'm your host, Anya Kelly Costolo. Today, I talk to Hannah Cormack, a performance artist based in so-called Australia. Hannah's work viscerally depicts the connectedness of our bodies and their needs with not only other human beings, but also the ecological systems we sometimes forget we're embedded within. Some of these ideas might seem abstract, but as our conversation unfolds, Hannah makes them tangible through taking us inside her own embodied experience and artistic practice. Let's dive in. I'm talking to Hannah Cormack. It's fantastic to have you here on Enabling Commons, Hannah. Could you start off by introducing yourself for us?
Thanks for having me. Hi. My name is Hannah Cormack, and I create art, particularly art that's occupied with physical embodiment or uses my body as a site of manifestation. And I co-create with both human and more than human collaborators. And I've worked as an artist for over 20 years, performing in Europe, Asia, and Australia. But for the last nearly 8 years, I've been located in an isolation room on unceded Ngunnawal and Ngambri country in Canberra, traversing the deep inner waters of climate illness.
Thank you so much. There was a lot to unpack in there. I'm going to pick up on other aspects of your artistic practice and journey in a moment, but I wonder if you can expand on that term for us, climate illness, because I think that's such a fascinating link between chronic illness and the climate crisis.
When I say climate illness, I'm talking about climate crisis mediated disease or illnesses of the climate era. In the same way that we have disrupted our ecosystem through our addiction to fossil fuels and fossil fuel derived materials, these pollutants have disrupted our genetics. And there are a host of conditions that, at a population level, are becoming both more severe and more prevalent. For me, that relates to genetic mutations and inherited immunologic disease. But there are plenty of other people living with illnesses that are driven by the cause and the effects of the climate crisis, including pollutants upregulating dormant genes, as well as the mutations within other species, bacteria, molds, ticks, mosquitoes, that have caused them to become more numerous and more dangerous to us, causing more severe secondary illnesses. Not only are these conditions triggered by this, but the planetary effects of the climate crisis, the bushfires, floods, heat waves, also then go on to make the conditions worse. And we're more susceptible to harm within these events. The terrible escalation events, tipping points, and feedback loops of the climate crisis are something our bodies are implicated within. The storms and fires and species collapse are happening inside our bodies also.
Wow, thank you for that tour of the many ways that our bodies and the climate crisis and planetary collapse are bound together and inseparable, despite the ways that so many people continue, particularly people in positions of power like fossil fuel CEOs, continue to treat the planet as this resource to be pulled from. I'm sure we'll circle back to a lot of these themes soon, but going back to your kind of previous art, you used to be a circus artist, and then fast forwarding, you know, several years, you've taken up performance art again, or continued performance art, but from a very different vantage point. And I wondered if you could share a bit more about that journey.
Yeah, it's perhaps more accurate to say that I was a physical artist, and that involved circus arts like contortion and acrobatics and clowning, but it also included things like dance, mask, trance performance, interdisciplinary art, and especially theatre, physical theatre. I trained at École Jacques Lecoq in Paris, so that kind of performing with my body. I guess you could say my practice was generally preoccupied with what my body could do and with physical virtuosity. And yeah, there's a beauty in that, but when you become physically disabled, you're forced to confront all of the different ableist mindsets that are threaded throughout those art forms and industries.
Yeah, that's such an intense thing to have to reckon with, I think, because a lot of us who were either not born disabled or not born with a condition that is directly maybe impacted by the thing that we put our livelihoods into, it's just like the socially dominant tropes of working as virtuosically and as hard as you can, I guess, to be at kind of peak performance and not necessarily taking into account what your body needs, right? I wondered what your embodied experience of disability and chronic illness has kind of taught you about how you approach art now.
When you become sick or disabled, your place in the kind of relational topography of the world has shifted, and you're suddenly in this different place, and you kind of need to come to art through different doorways or paths or bridges than you may have used before. But it allows you to realize these different pathways exist and are possible, because we're kind of taught to make art in this very narrow way, in a very capitalist way. In a very extractive way that is steeped in these kind of really industrialized philosophies. There's so much colonialism, there's so much capitalism, extractivism in the ways that we are taught to make. We're using time scarcity as an adrenaline motor to create. And we kind of treat our bodies, our tools, our resources, as resources. I mean, it's a very extractive relationship we're in with everything around us when we're making in the ways that we're taught to normally make, rather than viewing all of these other parts as collaborators with personhood. And I found that kind of shifting that relationship into a much more animist relationship, one which is not this hierarchical system which puts people and very particular people at the top of a pyramid. And then everything below that is, something that those people at the top can draw from, extract from for their own gains, to kind of create this horizontal field where everyone is equal. And that means not only all people, but also, my body has its own needs, its own wishes, and I can't just keep digging into it as a resource to be making art. I can't just use the more than human allies around me as a resource either. And I also think that lends towards how we allow other beings to have agency within our work, to give the space and time for that agency and their voices to come through. I think a lot of artists work with the more than human, but in a way that is still kind of extractive, in a way that uses all these beings around us as a feed source for our impulses.
I was interested in that you mentioned before, the more than human collaborators and like collaborators specifically, right? Rather than extracting from. And I wondered if you could elaborate on that and maybe give some examples.
Yeah. I mean, for example, when we're talking about, let's say we want to talk about working with a landscape or an earth site or trees or something like that. How much are we trying to really slow down to their time of being, trying to understand their language, trying to understand what they might want this artwork to be, to try to shift it out of that anthropocentric viewpoint of, you know, as art only being about human to human communication or only about human experience or human stories, and to think more biospherically, more systemically, that, you know, we are part of these big ecosystems. And I guess that means we have to sometimes give up our ideas in a way. I sometimes wonder, you know, are the artworks that I create, are the things that I make really my artworks, or am I a conduit for something else? Is everything that I make just kind of one word in a life-length letter that's being sent between, not even being sent by me, being sent by my ancestors or being sent by my birth soil to the soil that I'm on now? How am I a conduit for these artworks being made? So it's kind of, you know, loosening our grip on being in control of the art that we make and understanding that everything around us is part of that.
I wanted to hear a bit more about your performance piece, The Mermaid, because I think it's a really nice example of what you were talking about before with like the blurring of boundaries and not, you know, not having like the false separation between our bodies and the rest of the like human and more than human world and land and whatnot.
Sure. The Mermaid was the first work I created as a disabled artist, and it was also an act of coming out as disabled. I'd kind of been hiding the fact that I was sick from most people in my life, and especially from the industry that I worked in. And I wanted to have this act of radical visibility to confront my own internalized ableism and shame, because I recognized that shame is enabled by secrecy and hiding. And the alchemy of turning my dehumanized, medicalized body into art, of turning my private suffering into public activism and inviting the stares in, was kind of the most effective way I had of challenging that shame. And so the work placed my real mobility and medical aids, which were a wheelchair, oxygen tank, full face respirator mask, saline IV drip and body orthoses and splints, against this beautiful fantasy image of a mermaid. And through the mechanism of my disease, the audience were kind of asked to consider what our shared resources are and how our pollution of those resources disable the people, creatures, and systems around us. Although it's not even accurate to call it a resource. That's, again, an extractive relationship frame. It's more real to say that we're part of these systems. Mm. These systems are part of our bodies. Other bodies are part of our bodies. That we're microbially, immunologically stitched together as one organism. And what I do to my body, I'm doing to yours. What I put on or into my body, I'm putting on or into the air, the ocean, into your lungs, your veins, and vice versa.
Mm.
So my medical condition illustrates that reality in a very stark and unavoidable way. But it's true for all of us.
Mm-hmm.
You could say that we're porous beings, and where I begin and you end is mutable and indefinable, and where we create these boundaries between us, we're just making a choice. You know, the boundary we draw between ourselves and another is more of a thought experiment than it is a reality.
I think it's Alice Wong who talks about disabled oracles, right? And this idea of disabled people being, having particular knowledges that are sort of seeing into I don't even know if I want to frame it as looking into the future, because I think it's like being more conscious of the present that everybody is facing, but that maybe people who haven't thought as much about, tuned in as much to their own embodied experience and how they relate to everything else around us, are just not aware of that yet and not there yet. And I just wanted to say also that that is such a like badass coming out as disabled. Like that's incredible.
Our bodies talk to us in illness and disability in ways which are very articulate, very complex, very loud, and in ways that kind of really take over control, especially for chronically ill people. There's a real understanding of how the body calls the shots,
mm-hmm.
not your will force. I've kind of started to come to understand the things that happen in my body where it's my body taking agency. For example, if I have a moment, if I'm experiencing paralysis and I can't move and it's my body saying, you know, I might want to move, but my body is saying no.
Mm.
Or I might not want to move, but my body says, yes, I want to move, and I'm experiencing a seizure or a dystonic storm.
Mm.
Or I might say, oh, I want to breathe, but my body says, no, this is not the time to breathe, and my throat swells shut. You know, there's my body is deciding when I'm upright, when I'm awake and conscious, when I'm not. And I think I started to come to realize this not just as an illness, not just as a breaking down, but as a kind of the chaotic struggle that occurs when the body is trying to reharmonize itself. I started to see it as a kind of involuntary rewilding of my body, a kind of cellular revolution, trying to push against the way I'd been living in this kind of really hyper-extractive way before I became sick.
Mm-hmm. And I think that feeds really beautifully into, you know, what we can draw from the like wisdom that we gain, right, as chronically ill people when we are more in tune with our body because we need to be, but understanding that for responses to the fragility of our planet as well. I think it was in your interview for the ABC, which is Australia's public media for listeners who might not know it, but that sometimes with performances, like the performances that you were working on, I think at the time of that interview, you said something like they may or may not continue, and that will be based on like, you know, for medical reasons or other reasons, and you just kind of have to see. And bringing the fact of how a performance is on a given day into like making visible the fact that you have a medical team available like on site in case something happens, and that if it does, well, you know, the performance will have to stop, and that will be part of it, I think is really cool, because so often it's like the health side or the something that's seen as like a unacceptable vulnerability or something like that is not allowed to be in that space, right?
Yeah, I really wanted to make that that kind of precarity part of the fabric of the work.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was the reality that we were dealing with. And that kind of is the work more than the words that are said or the actions. And it's true that, you know, sharing a space with other humans is immunologically really tricky for me, especially when it moves through the air. So, you know, the mermaid looks at a lot of different shared spaces that we all exist within. But the air is probably one of the most present ones within that work. And I was at risk of, you know, serious medical events, including anaphylaxis, seizures, dystonic storms, respiratory distress, and they could interrupt the work at any moment, any number of times. And when that happened, what we would do is that, one of the assistants would come and ascertain what medical event was occurring and would kind of communicate to the other assistants what was going on and what we needed to do. And usually we'd have some very loud surf rock music that would start playing. And, you know, for example, I might be having a seizure on the ground. There's this surf rock music playing, and suddenly the assistants are holding up these big cue cards and also speaking through a megaphone, explaining what's going on, that I'm having this medical event, why I'm having this medical event, because of particular immunologic triggers that are in the air that have been brought into the air by the audience.
Mm.
And the audience's complicity in that event, their complicity in the pollution of that resource. And it happened, I think there are about 10 medical events that happened over all of the performances of The Mermaid that have occurred,
mm-hmm.
Sometimes multiple in one showing. Mm. And I'd say the most happened at the Sydney Fest, some of the Sydney Festival performances, which was, again, it was a heightened risk space because we were doing that during the bushfire emergency that was happening in Australia at the time.
Mm.
And so not only were we dealing with kind of the pollutants that the audience were bringing in, but we were dealing with the pollutants. Everyone was dealing with the pollutants in the air from the fires. And of course, it's that same model that these fires that have been brought about through the climate crisis, that we had been, you know, making all of these small choices that had this big impact that then we realized was coming back to impact us. The air was something very tangible for the audience during that particular season. Because, you know, the air, it was bright orange. It tasted like ash. They realized that the air was not an emptiness. It was a population of endless entities reaching in through their windows, reaching in through their masks and their tear ducts to interact with them. And that kind of entanglement that we live within was just much more clear for everyone during those performances. But it was a lot harsher on my body. It took months and months and months to recover from those performances.
Mm. Yeah, that's so interesting about that, because for you and for a lot of people with, you know, even conditions like asthma or conditions where the quality of the air becomes immediately apparent to you, it's something that you can kind of never forget about, right? But for a lot of people, it's only when the air quality is especially bad. And it's interesting that it also had the, it was visibly different and it tasted different, and all those aspects on top of each other made it more tangible for the audience, but also put you through a lot more. But I just, I love that, making the any medical events politicized. I recognize that that's definitely not something that everybody would have access to be able to do, but it's really cool that you can bring that into your art. One of the themes that you were talking about before was time, and like being in tune with the sort of time scales of the land and of the planet more broadly, which is also making me think about how in well-meant responses to planetary breakdown, climate breakdown, there's often a narrative about running out of time or needing to act as quickly as possible, which is true, we do. But if we set a date by which we've run out of time, we're going to get to that date and we're still going to need to do stuff, right? And I feel like having a more fluid sense of how we need to be in this for the long haul as best as we can, and that that's actually healthier rather than thinking in a kind of urgency way. Just thinking about how you were talking about your relationship with the land and planet in relation to being more mindful of those timescales.
Time is, it's something that's, I guess I've had to come into relationship with in a very different way, mm-hmm. in making the art. I've come into relationship with time in a way which is much more non-linear.
Mm-hmm.
And I do have some works that look at time in these kind of expanded ways. Dream Remember is a work that I created for Climate Change Theatre Action, which was a kind of participatory ritual that allowed for audiences to create their own kind of shared experience of remembering or dreaming, because it kind of gave this idea that it's pulled us outside of that kind of human idea of the arrow of time. It pulled it into a kind of, I guess, more quantum relationship, where we're looking at maybe we can remember the future. And it brings that a little bit back as well to that kind of disabled oracle that Alice Wong brought up. And I was present at the original performance of that online through Assemblies for the Future.
Mm.
And being another disabled person in that virtual space, it was really, you know, there is that kind of feeling that some of us are already living the future. Some of us are already living deep in climate crisis. In Dream Remember, the work itself was kind of looking at this slow ritualized act, which was sometimes real and sometimes false, of a group walking into a lake to try and call forth from their bodies hidden yearnings and wishes, ancestral wisdom that maybe came drawn from the past, or maybe memories of the future that hadn't happened yet. And it was kind of turning everyone into this single body, or kind of like a brain all together, just kind of together trying, looking at thought and memory as a collective act.
Mm.
And trying to search out into those spots that we can sense a little bit are there, and moving just past that, just outside the border of imagination. So that was kind of experiencing time in a way that was a more kind of fluid concept. But I think time also is really present in how I work, just through the concept of the manner of working. Living in isolation in the way I do means that I've kind of slipped out of what I would call a human timescale. And as well as, you know, living with so much immense fatigue, living in the horizontal plane so much, 99% mm-hmm. of my time is lying down. So I'm not in that human-to-human relational timescale. I'm in relationship between the earth and the sky. That's a slower time. And I find that I've kind of slipped into this temporal reality that's closer to trees and stones than it is to the human, where days can pass and it takes a whole day for a very big thought to come in and exist. And that makes me think a lot about trees generally, and how, you know, capitalism loves a monoculture. We love to make all these plantations of trees that grow really fast, and we can cut them down and turn them into things. And that's how we make art as well. That's how we've industrialized art making. And we create art within these kind of very rigid time frames.
Mm.
We like to make them fast and quick, but we've created a monoculture of our art. And I think of the trees that are, that grow really slowly, that are really weird and dense and twisted, and they might go for years and look like they haven't grown at all. Or maybe all that growth is happening underground through a vast root system that we can't see. And maybe their growth is happening in a way that the wood is becoming more dense, or there are certain chemicals coming through that plant. And it's those sorts of trees, those slow trees, those strange trees that are the medicinal ones so often. And so I think about how by creating art in this very kind of homogenized timescale, we're missing out on all these other types of art trees that could be existing. And that disability and illness and these different ways that we're forced into different temporal relationships, different temporospatial relationships allow us to be exploring these spaces, these places of wisdom, these ways of being that bring new wisdom and new types of art and thought into being. So, yeah, for me, leaning into that slowness has been a really big deal in my art and my survival. I suppose another image I have is like a river. A river can be fast and have its rapids and its waterfalls, and those are important in moments. Mm-hmm. But there are also moments that it's very important for that river to slow down. And we see that a lot in research around rewilding and how having these sorts of animals that are building dams within the rivers, trees that are dropping their branches into the rivers and allowing it to slow down in different places, really affects the biodiversity in that area. It affects the soil. It prevents flooding, and it changes what's happening inside the water, where the water is forced to slow down and the plants are leaching all their tannins into there, and it's transforming. And so I think of these moments of when we're forced into stillness, slowness. It's not really a stillness and slowness. It only is through that kind of human capitalistic lens, because in that slowness, there is immense movement and transformation, but it's a different kind of transformation. It's like a, it's like tea steeping. It's that change that requires slowness and stillness to occur.
I'm thinking about how slow is a relative term, right? And maybe so much of those time scales are, as you say, nonlinear and just at the speed that it needs to be, rather than, you know, slow in relation to extractive ways of living. And, you know, it's telling as well that it's so easy to say, like, oh, a human timescale is this way, is capitalist. But of course, a human timescale doesn't have to be like that. And lots of indigenous cultures, and, you know, there would have been ways of living before capitalism and before the Industrial Revolution and all of that, that were less frenetic and less extractive. And yeah, I think there have definitely been disabled people, you know, talking about the concept of crip time, or I would interpret what you're saying as basically putting crip time in like an ecological context, or like bringing it into relationship with rewilding and trees and rivers and being horizontal.
What you mentioned about, you know, how we frame a human timescale, you're right. Like, that's a very, when we use those words, we are talking about the human overculture, not all humans. There are many, many, many cultures that live in ways that have these kind of much more expansive relationships with time. And I found that really helpful, recognizing that. It makes me remember that the way I'm existing as a sick person, as a disabled person who has these different relationships with space and time, is not wrong.
Mm-hmm.
It's not broken. For the on the one hand, there are just so many different human cultures that were living that way, that are still living this way, and that there are all of the more than human beings who are living this way. And I often think about kind of drawing wisdom from that and how there's no broken way of being. There's no such thing as a broken body. We're just shifted into different temporospatial relationships that bring us closer to our more than human kin. I guess I become a little bit suspicious of using language like illness and sickness. I mean, on the one hand, I do, you know, we recognize these are real things and that the suffering people who are sick that we experience, that's very real. But what is this kind of idea of a wellness illness binary? It's a binary that's normally drawn along capitalistic lines. It's often, you know, you're well if you can work and your body can be exploited under capitalism, and you're sick if it can't. But I also think about, like, what is illness and wellness when we're on a planet that's in crisis? Not even on a planet, that we are part of a planet that's in crisis at the moment. And is there such a thing as wellness when the planet's in crisis? Or are they only these kind of temporary moments of equilibrium or respite in the middle of this chaos, and that none of us can be truly well until we're all well and in harmony, living in harmony and no longer destroying each other?
I love that, the reciprocity and the mutuality that's needed to be able to move towards more restorative states for ourselves as part of the wider planetary ecosystems.
Yeah. So in that sense, you know, I do think that personal healing, and again, that's a really tricky concept to talk about, healing. What does that even mean? But I think about it relationally. And how are we healing relationship at every level? The relationship to our own bodies, our relationship to each other as humans, our relationship to more than human entities, our relationship to the ecosystem that we're in, our cell's relationship to another cell within our body. Yeah, how can all of that be in a state of harmony and reciprocity? And I think that's, for me, what healing really means.
That's beautiful. I was going to ask you as well whether you had sort of any advice for disabled artists, or chronically ill artists wanting to sort of bring these planetary connections more to the fore. And I think you've talked a lot about the way that you work maybe being the fundamental thing, right, that leads to the output.
And what we view as kind of moments of non-making, or as a kind of creative block even, that's that stillness point where the tea is brewing, where the things are transforming. We're just shifting into different time scales of creating, and that there's no right or wrong way to do this. There's no right or wrong way to create or to exist as a body. Any possible way that your body could be is bringing to you something new. My wheelchair makes me understand a different type of movement. I was doing some research with another disabled dancer, Rihanna Hetusson, a kind of vertical walking human body has a movement that's based around torsion and undulation. But the wheelchair using body has a different movement going on. The movement of the shoulder blades made the exact same kind of figure eight movements that the wingtips of birds make when they're flying. And so we were discovering how being a wheelchair user is actually also like being a bird and flying, and also how, you know, the wheels they never leave the ground. And so you're kind of bringing into that that concept of what it is to be the serpent or the snake whose belly is always touching Mother Earth, and always bringing up that connection with the ground. So kind of to throw off the shackles of the idea of there being one type of body that is useful to the world, and to say that all bodies are useful, no matter what spatial relationship you're in, no matter what time relationship you're in.
I'm also thinking about a disabled scholar, Arseli Dokoumassi, not quite sure if I'm pronouncing her name correctly, but has a recent book called Activist Affordances, and it talks about how these like everyday like different ways of moving, or like different ways of holding an object or getting around, or just like imagining something into being in a like non-normative way, making them visible as things that everybody does, but the disabled people especially have to do, and making visible the fact that like there can be, not always, but that there can be like good sides to having to experiment.
I think it is Dan Dore who says this, that incredible disabled dancer, and he talks about disability being inherently creative. We're forced to be creative because we always have to find a different way of doing things, because the world is not set up in such a way to support ease for us, for bodies that are not how the overculture thinks a body should be. And also, you know, the privilege of slowing down. On the one hand, a lot of us are forced into that because suddenly our bodies cannot move at higher rate. And the problem is, it's like when there's a push coming from one side, which is that kind of capitalist push of maybe you don't have the ability to slow down because you have to keep going to work, you have to not, you know, you have to survive. But then when the medical stress of that, you know, comes in, that we're just forced into making these kinds of really difficult choices to survive. And sometimes that means burning out our body so bad that it takes years and years and years to recover. Sometimes it means having to step out of the socially acceptable way of existing in society and doing this kind of slowing down and listening to our bodies. And if we're surviving it at all, it's because there's one thread of privilege we have somewhere that we're able to hold on to. I don't use the word privilege with a sense of, I don't want anyone to be feeling a sense of shame around that. I don't want to be using shame as a weapon at all. I don't think that's part of how we create change, but I think it's kind of just being aware that this need for a privilege to survive these systems is only because the systems themselves don't have the space for us.
Exactly, yeah. Systems are broken. It shows how broken the systems are that it is a privilege to be able to survive when our bodies are breaking down, and that like given the existence of so much precarity, that actually all human beings and more than human rest of world lives with, we should be taking that as like a fundamental aspect rather than something that only those who are already basically on top are going to be able to deal to when it hits hard, right?
It hits hard for everyone at some point. In some crip politics circles, the label for people who are not disabled is temporarily non-disabled or not yet disabled. Because if you know, survive on a long enough time scale, eventually something will happen where you'll be shifted into that category of disability. mind yourself in a way that the relationship between your body and the space that you're in is suddenly no longer one that's easy. So, yeah, it's how do we make our systems inclusive enough, flexible enough, expansive enough, responsive enough to hold all of these different ways of being so we don't need to have privilege on our side to survive. A disabled body is so aware of their environment always. And by environment, I mean like just the space that you were in, the spaces that we're in and not set up for our bodies. And so we're really aware of them. Because if we're not, we either might not be able to function or it might be, you know, a huge risk for us. And that very awareness is kind of a gift in a way. It sucks to have these barriers. It's terrible. But the awareness allows for us to have relationships that are ethical, mindful.
Anna, thank you so much. It's a real privilege to be able to talk to you. And I really, really appreciate your sharing all of your insights.
Thank you very much for having me.
Please help us spread the word about Enabling Commons. Share it with a friend or link to it in your organization's newsletter. With thanks to Rose Paquet for producing transcripts and podcast promotion. The music is composed and produced by Sam Morgan. Audio production and hosting is by me, Anya Kelly Costello. To find out more about the intersections of disability and climate change, visit disabilityinclusiveclimate.org.